Welcome back to the Thermodiet Podcast. Today we have a very special guest for you all, Georgi Dinkov, aka Heydut, aka the Bulgarian Wizard, aka the man, the myth, the legend, Georgi Dinkov. How are you doing, Georgi?
I'm fine. Thanks for the introduction. I agree. Heydut, the rebel. The rest, we'll see if I become a myth or legend.
Yeah.
Most people that became myths and legends didn't end up well, so I try to avoid that.
That's true. On our last podcast, we had a couple really funny YouTube comments, and one of them I thought was really funny, I think you'd enjoy, was, I'm a simple man. I see Heydut, I click Heydut.
I like that. Yep. I'll make a sticker and put it here in the office.
There you go. Also, by the way, your office, the new office is looking really good. I don't know if you still have
it's,
the old place.
It's the same as the old office. I just cleaned up a little bit, like removed a few boxes. But it's the same office, same building. I haven't moved. There's like another box here, but it's, one box and it's not as visible as the others.
Awesome. Well, today we're going to be talking about histamine, serotonin, gut health in general, and how that cascade of inflammation that really starts with this ubiquitous toxin, as we know it, endotoxin.
Yep.
So, George, I have a hypothesis and like more kind of my working idea of how this all works. And I was doing some research and listening to some Ray and some of your stuff. And so pause me wherever you want. I'm just going to kind of give a little summary to the listeners. So gut irritating foods are basically anything that make it to the colon undigested and that is fermentable. So not including things like carrots or, the cellulose or, certain types of fats that have antibacterial effects or polyphenols or foods that are absorbed through the gut lining. When they make it to the colon, these foods increase the rate at which bacteria produce endotoxin or reproduce, which results in an increase in endotoxin. Serotonin is then emitted by the enterochromaffin cells, which are the cells in the gut lining. The cells, in order to speed up transit, to stimulate peristalsis, to get these foods out. And then the endotoxin increases the serotonin release. Then the endotoxin and any food absorbed in the bloodstream create an immune response, so which is like the inflammatory cascade that our immune system recognizes like these foreign invaders. So our mast cells start attacking these with histamines, the leukotrienes, the prostaglandins to kill the foreign invaders, just like they were, a virus or anything or a parasite like that. And then nitric oxide, which they say histamine is a nitric or a vasodilator, but I would kind of think that it was really the histamine signaling to increase nitric oxide synthesis, and that's what causes the increase in blood flow to that area and probably the swelling and the edema and all that.
Yep. Sounds about right. And also you had a question there, like what's the role of like nitric oxide, just to, how does it play? Nitric oxide is actually the primary sort of like weapon that is released to kill the pathogens. So even though it's a vasodilator, whenever you have like a foreign invasion by like a virus or bacteria or anything the body perceives as an infection, then it starts synthesizing nitric oxide. So the primary role of nitric oxide is because it is itself a reactive oxygen and nitrogen species, the body produces it to basically kill off the invaders. The prostaglandins, the leukotrienes, the thromboxanes, the various other cytokines, they're there for that as well. But the nitric oxide is the primary weapon. And then its secondary effect is it causes vasodilation as well. Serotonin is also vasoactive. It also causes vasodilation directly. So histamine, really, because it stimulates the release of serotonin and nitric oxide, that's what really causes the subsequent vasodilating effect. Unfortunately, serotonin, once it's released, by activating the 5-HT3 receptor, which is mostly expressed in the gut and secondarily in the brain, that activation of the receptor increases the gut permeability and allows more endotoxin to enter into the bloodstream. So it's really, the role of the serotonin is kind of like the body is doing the best it can to speed up the transit of the food that's now filled up with these toxins, but it does have a price, and the price is that increases the permeability of the intestine. So you have a situation, since you had a question there, like how can serotonin be simultaneously increase and decrease gut motility? Well, actually, serotonin increases gut motility in the small intestine, but decreases it in the large. And over time, because of the inflammatory effects that it has largely in the large intestine, because the 5-HT2 receptors are mostly expressed there, then the colon will swell. So basically, you're going to have a situation where no matter how much you speed up the transit in the small intestine, eventually you're going to hit like from like a larger pipe to a much smaller pipe, right? To or like a hose. And then this so you basically, you're going to have a block, right? And you can actually, the large intestine can actually swell to the point of completely blocking off any food transfer. I'm sorry, stool transfer. And it's common for people with inflammatory disorders of the colon to have what they call a pencil stool. Basically, like the stool is very, very thin and looks like a winding piece of rope. And that's basically caused by a number of these, all of these vasoactive amines, as we want to call them, histamine, serotonin, ammonia also does it, another amine, right? And nitric oxide. So even though it's a vasodilatory and anti-pathogen, their chronic effect is actually inflammatory and causes over time, even it will cause like structural changes. It can actually cause like fibrotic changes in the intestine. And eventually you can get something called impacted colon, which is complete blockage. And then that's usually considered a surgical emergency. And then they have to rush you to the hospital and, you know, cut you open and cut that portion out because it's really dysfunctional.
So you said serotonin will act as a vasodilator in the small intestine to increase transit to the large intestine. And then so things get blocked there. So that also kind of makes sense to me in that, do you think most of the nutrient persorption, and we know the endotoxins feeding through the large intestine, am I wrong? Am I correct on the nutrient persorption as well? Or is that mostly in the small intestine?
The nutrient persorption is supposed to be mostly in the small intestine. That's why if you eat food that's easily digestible, you're going to absorb almost all of the stuff that can be absorbed, that can be processed in the stomach and the small intestine. So by the time it reaches the colon, there will be nothing for the bacteria to consume. So it's not going to increase their turnover, and it's not going to cause the release of the endotoxin from the dead gram-negative bacteria.
So do you think, like with gluten and starch, is it the issue are they getting into the bloodstream from the small intestine or from if they make it into the large intestine?
Oh, I think the gluten is absorbed into the from the small intestine. It is an absorbable protein.
Okay.
I think the problem of gluten and several other of these problematic proteins found in grains is that gluten is actually a relatively potent opioid agonist. And opioid agonists are known to cause constipation, in other words, to drastically slow down the transit, which allows basically more bacteria to eat whatever has remained undigested from food. And also, gluten seems to be directly can stimulate the release of serotonin from the enterochromaffin cells, because opioid agonists, by activating that receptor, I think it's the mu-1 receptor, that activation of the receptor itself triggers the synthesis de novo of histamine by the enzyme histidine decarboxylase, and also the synthesis of serotonin by tryptophan hydroxylase. So opioids are really like very bad substances, and it's been known for a very long time that once a cancer patient gets to the point of them being given opioids for the pain, they're pretty much done. Like basically, even if you're giving chemotherapy and other things that they're reacting to, it's known that the opioids actually kill them. And the way they kill them is by drastically increasing the release of histamine and serotonin. Those things are vasodilatory. They activate something called vascular endothelial growth factor. It drastically speeds up the tumor growth, both of the primary tumor and the metastasis, and then the patient expires. Mm-hmm. So basically the gluten, and there are other proteins, not just gluten. I think whey has some of those effects. But the casein has also anti-inflammatory effects, so it balances it out. Yeah. While the whey protein seems to be directly irritating to the gut through as of yet unknown mechanism, mostly because of its, I think, very strong acidity. And anytime you irritate the intestine, it doesn't have to be chemical irritation, it could be mechanical as well. So if you're running, for example, that bouncing up and down all the time, that kind of stretches the intestine, and that is itself sufficient to actually release the histamine that is stored in the mast cells. And just the mechanical twisting and stretching of the intestine doesn't like that. It perceives it as a kind of like a low-grade trauma, and then it's going to start releasing histamine, serotonin, and nitric oxide in an attempt to repair itself, or at least to speed up the transit, because I guess the intestine thinks that there's something inside that's causing this stuff, right?
Yeah.
I don't think the intestine has a way of knowing that it's the running doing it, but having the runs, the proverbial runs as a long distance runner, that's a thing. You know, they basically, some marathon runners run in diapers for that reason, because you know, it's going to cause the diarrhea, which is an indication of drastically increased production of serotonin.
I never thought about that quite literally as the runs. So that kind of makes sense to the point we were talking about before, where it's like, so the serotonin's increase and the exercise induced gut, let's not say dysbiosis, but the effects of exercise on the gut. It's taking blood flow away from the intestines, and the serotonin is also, you said, is from the mechanical damage is being increased. And then it's exactly what you said, where it's decreasing blood flow away from the large intestine, or not predominantly, but also, which is going to increase the, allow for more absorption of endotoxins, going to allow for more leaky gut, and which is also going to cause sort of the increased histamine release.
More histamine, more serotonin, than endotoxin will activate TLR4, which is the main like endotoxin receptor. That itself triggers an entire inflammatory cascade of all the prostaglandins, leukotrienes, more nitric oxide, more serotonin. But because about 90% of serotonin is produced in the gut, like this exercise sort of like, induced serotonin release is really, that's really the key component, the key negative component of exercise. One of them. The second one is the increased lipolysis. But they go hand in hand, right? It's basically like even if you're running to the point or exercising to the point that you're only using glycogen, you're not using as much fat. Basically, just this mechanical going up and down, we're talking about endurance exercise, not so much weightlifting. The inflammatory cascade that it triggers, just the release of serotonin and histamine, that itself will activate the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, because the body says, wow, inflammation, right? Something activated TLR4, I need to release more cortisol to basically block it. Yeah, but if you release cortisol, that also triggers subsequently the release of adrenaline. So you're going to be increasing lipolysis even if you actually have the glycogen stores to provide the cells with glucose instead of forcing them to burn fat. So it's really a cascade. In other words, anything that's perceived as a trauma or like an unpleasant exertion will probably trigger these adaptive mechanisms. And there are also other ones. For example, whenever you exercise, even at a very low pace, very low intensity, you're going to have some cellular breakdown. And multiple studies have demonstrated that the presence of mitochondrial fragments into the bloodstream basically triggers the exact same mechanisms as if you were under some kind of a viral attack. Basically, the body does not like these cellular fragments. It thinks that, the role of the immune system. Now, there's an old theory, but now it's becoming fashionable again, is that it's so-called morphostatic. In other words, the role of the immune system is to keep you looking the way you look right now. And when you start breaking apart, at a low grade due to the exercise, these cellular debris need to be cleaned up as quickly as possible, because otherwise they will serve as food for many other pathogens that are always floating around. We always have some level of bacteria or viruses or God forbid fungi, because that can be deadly, floating around. And the body says, all of these cellular fragments, if the cell is intact, it's relatively impermeable to these pathogens. It's not as easy to actually serve as food. But when they're in fragments, they're ready to be consumed. So when you're exercising, and depending on the degree to which you exercise, you create this like cellular breakdown, right? And then that can actually trigger a lot of these responses, even in the absence of serotonin, histamine, and endotoxin. I don't know if you've ever overexercised, but just the next day, even if you're just lifting weights, which is not that taxing on the gastrointestinal tract, but after that, like if you have this like massive muscle soreness for days, what comes with it is also this feeling of malaise. Mm-hmm. People often have fevers, right? And the reason you have fevers is because, like I said, the body treats this as if you're under some kind of a viral attack. And it's going to increase basically the synthesis of serotonin, nitric oxide, and histamine to try to kill off or at least dispose of these cellular debris. So stress, whether it's directly at the GI tract or peripherally, triggers the exact same basic mechanisms of cleanup and repair. Now, if this is done on a regular basis, we're getting into a situation where you may end up in some of these chronic inflammatory disorders, usually inflammatory bowel disease or some other autoimmune condition. Very multiple sclerosis rates have been rising lately. Now there's already an established link between multiple sclerosis and inflammatory bowel disease, or at least irritable bowel syndrome, or at the very least increased gut leakage, right? I know several medical doctors who start telling their patients with MS to stop consuming grains because of the gluten, or at least to stop consuming the wheat and the various other grains that contain the gluten. They're saying, we're seeing an exacerbation of symptoms, when you consume these foods. Now, cutting these foods is probably not going to cure it, but at least we're seeing these people going to remission. So there's definitely a contributing factor. And if the main effect of gluten is to basically trigger the serotonin, endotoxin, histamine, nitric oxide system, then we know that these mediators are pathogenic for the brain and in general for the body. So we should do everything possible to avoid chronically increasing them. Now, they do have their physiological role, right? Don't get me wrong. Doesn't mean they should be zero, but they should be acute, right? Mm-hmm. You have a wound. If you have a wound and you cut yourself, or you just injure yourself, or you just a tiny little wound, then you're going to get swelling and you're going to get redness and you're going to get itching. That's really the role of these vasoactive substances, is to increase the blood flow, right? Send off a lot of white blood cells there. Histamine increases the permeability of cells to the white blood cells so they can get in there and protect you from infection, right? Estrogen is also activated because it stimulates cell division. So you need to fill up the wound. But then this process is supposed to complete. And once the wound is sealed off and the body thinks it's no longer under attack, then everything goes back to normal, right? There are these negative feedback mechanisms. One of them is the histamine receptor H3. It serves as a feedback receptor. So anything that activates H3 is going to decrease the release of histamine. However, several studies have demonstrated that people with abnormally high serotonin or nitric oxide, the H3 receptor seems to stop functioning, or at least become greatly desensitized. So the feedback mechanism, negative feedback mechanism for histamine, seems to get turned off. And we're seeing something similar with estrogen and cortisol and estrogen, right? So if you do this thing long enough, you're going to interfere with some of these negative feedback mechanisms that are there to stop from these largely pathological mediators from basically, you know, destroying you over the long run. They have their physiological function short term, but I don't think there's any doubt based on the evidence that we've seen that long-term elevation of serotonin, long-term elevation of histamine, of cortisol, of nitric oxide, that all of these things are bad. It's not a coincidence that we have antihistamine drugs on the market. The medicine has recognized the pathogenicity of histamine for a very long time, I think almost 100 years at this point.
Yeah, so that brings up a good question, and I was looking into this a little bit. How is it just that the antihistamine drugs are acting on the same receptors as, and they're blocking serotonin, or is it more so that they're protecting against the leaky gut and serotonin being, and the endotoxin coming through into the immune system or the blood?
It looks like serotonin and histamine, just like estrogen and cortisol, are almost like, you know, twin brothers or twin sisters, or twins, let's call them twins. So several studies have shown that H2 antagonists, which are used as an antacid drugs, because the H2 receptor mostly expressed in the stomach and activated by histamine, you produce stomach acid. By the way, only if you produce sufficient carbon dioxide. You cannot have good production. So if you have high histamine but low CO2, which, by the way, high histamine will cause eventually, you're not going to get good acid production. Anyways, so the H2 antagonists, which were developed as antacid drugs, a recent study, not very recent, but I think I posted it maybe 2 or 3 years on the forum, showed that the H2 antagonist famotidine, a drug that I particularly like a lot, is basically was capable of stopping a full-blown serotonin syndrome in a patient in a hospital, and serotonin syndrome without immediate treatment, and sometimes even with immediate treatment, has a very high mortality rate, 20 to 40%. So the people who published the case study opined that the histamine receptors and serotonin have like a feedback mechanism. In other words, if you block some of these histamine receptors, you're going to interfere, or at least you're going to send a signal to not produce any more serotonin than there already is. So it looks like the histamine, by the way, histamine is such a versatile amine. If you look at its structure, it's not that different from serotonin. So it's quite possible that histamine is either capable of directly activating the serotonin receptors, or more likely, something that has already been proven, it is capable of activating the enzyme tryptophan hydroxylase. So it's going to increase the production of histamine. Conversely, serotonin is known to activate histidine decarboxylase, while simultaneously serotonin competes with histamine for degradation through some of these same pathways that histamine gets degraded with.
Both of which require CO2, right? I know the histamine does. Exactly. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
CO2, copper, also NAD, right?
Yep.
And ultimately ATP. So ATP is involved in virtually every enzymatic reaction that you have out there.
So this brings up one of the questions that we had was, should we be avoiding high histamine / high histidine foods? Or do we need to, is it more so in PUFAs? Or do we need to just avoid gut irritating foods and also support things with fresh fruit for CO2 and NAD. NAD, we use niacinamide and copper as well for diamine oxidase, which is the histamine breakdown molecule. the end zone.
I mean, I don't know of any good reason why would you want to consume food that's high in histamine. If it's already preformed, we know that it's being absorbed. Several studies have already proven that. So it's kind of like would you consume, is it good to consume foods that are high in endotoxin? I think the answer is no. And it's known that endotoxin is very high in like aged meats. So some people would go to like to the steakhouse and I know because I've been there and they advertise that these really like a month aged steak is very expensive. It's very tender and juicy and whatnot. You're eating decaying meat. By the way, and that's first of all, because as soon as the animal is dead and the immune system is no longer, you know, in control, you're going to have a bacterial invasion. Bacteria loves to eat that, right? But they also produce, in addition to the endotoxin, these toxic, amines such as putrescine and cadaverine. And the very names tell you that it's basically related to, you know, to a cadaver. You're eating decaying meat, right? So doesn't sound very yummy to me. Of course, with, you know, condiments and whatnot and cooking it, in a specific way, you can make it palatable, but you're ingesting a lot of endotoxin and a lot of these toxic amines. So if you ever have a food that in front of it that you know contains significant amounts of histamine, endotoxin, or serotonin, I don't think it's wise to eat it. Now, if you have to eat it for whatever reason, usually taking a little bit of charcoal with it helps. Eating the carrot salad with that food would also help because the insoluble fiber in the carrot would absorb a lot of these toxins, right? But in general, you should be avoiding it. And then a secondary thing is basically speeding up, just in case some of it absorbs or enough of it absorbs to cause problem, then basically keeping gastric motility as quick as possible or short as possible should be also a prerogative, which means, again, the insoluble fiber. And keeping inflammation low. So eating the easily digestible food and things that don't mechanically or chemically irritate the intestine. So it's both. It's either or. Mm-hmm. But very few people realize that many of the foods that are out there contain significant amounts of histamine and serotonin to be actually problematic. For example, if you eat kiwi, even if it's very ripe, you're going to absorb, if you eat two kiwis, which is not that much, you're going to absorb a significant amount of serotonin to actually cause a mild version of a serotonin syndrome. You're going to get like anxiety. Well, not guaranteed, but it's been shown that it can be caused. The amount of serotonin absorbed from the kiwi is sufficient to basically give you an anxiety, flushing, chills, fever, etc. Right? So knowing what foods contain these vasoactive substances, these biological active substances is important. In general, fresh food and well-cooked food is probably the best. So if you're going to be eating fresh food, fresh ripe fruit is probably best, right? The three exceptions that I know that could be problematic are pineapples, kiwis, and bananas. But because bananas contain a significant amount of tryptophan, but it seems to be mostly in the peel and these little white strings that sometimes get attached to the banana when you peel it. As long as you remove those, then the banana is mostly starch, right? Yep. That's a separate question, but at least you remove most of the tryptophan. Other than that, ripe fruits that basically contain, you know, the simple sugars, preferably a lot of, you know, a decent amount of fructose, maybe like half of it to limit the insulinogenic response, just like the table sugar sucrose. And then as much as possible, insoluble fiber. I think we need on the range of 3 to 4 grams of insoluble fiber daily in order for us to have like a, you know, decent gastric motility. One that does not endanger us from like chronic, you know, absorption of endotoxin triggering the serotonin, histamine, nitric oxide in the cortisol system.
So would you be a fan of like doing maybe two smaller carrot salads, multiple ones throughout the day, or?
Depending on the food. So I would usually eat the carrot salad with the largest meal of the day because it's the amount of food that also matters. There's basically your digestive tract is like a limited capacity for absorption of some of the nutrients. So which means that, you know, if you eat more than you can absorb, obviously it's going to get to the large intestine and reach the microbiome, and then all hell breaks loose, right? So I don't think it needs to be eaten with every meal because it will also absorb some of the things that you want to. I mean, it will absorb and prevent the absorption of some of the beneficial things, such as vitamins and minerals. So I think once a day is okay, out of personal experience. Now, if somebody has a very sensitive stomach and basically eating even a very small meal gives them like a stress reaction, then I think eating the carrot salad or taking a capsule, just a single one capsule of charcoal, it's probably warranted until their symptoms subside. Or try to take some of the antihistamine drugs. Like famotidine seems to be a very good one because now it's been proven to have effect not only on histamine, but also on serotonin. And even though it's advertised as an H2 specific antagonist, several studies have shown that there is no such thing as a receptor specific histamine antagonist. All of them are capable of antagonizing all of the receptors if taken in sufficiently high dosage. So, and I know people who have asthma and have several severe allergies. And when they take famotidine, these symptoms disappear, even though famotidine is not supposed to help because it's not an H1 antagonist. It's only H2 antagonist. But I think the fact that it helps improve digestion so much, very often these allergic reactions and just symptoms of allergies in general are actually symptoms of intestinal irritation. They're not direct allergic reaction to a pollen or anything like that, which it does exist. I don't want to say it doesn't exist at all, but more often than not, when you have an allergic reaction, stuffy nose, you know, like itchy eyes and whatnot, chances are that it's your gut that's irritated and it's not something, you know, floating around in the air.
Yeah, it's just like exacerbating what your poor health already. Yeah. So, yeah. This is kind of tangential, but autoimmune conditions are generally something that, you know, for whatever reason, you know, celiac disease, you eat gluten and it, for whatever reason, it starts to attack your own small intestine. You know, you have a number of autoimmune conditions. Do you have any speculation or what are your thoughts on like what is really?
Not even speculation. Every single one of these conditions, and not only the ones related to the GI tract, are known to involve histamine. There are even like a small clinical trials with like, 20 to 30 people showing that histamine antagonists can actually induce remission in many of these conditions, especially the GI related ones and also multiple sclerosis. It's not to the level of a full blown clinical trial where the FDA would agree with that. But the evidence for histamine's involvement in autoimmune conditions is beyond any dispute. Just a simple search in Google of histamine and autoimmune condition, you're going to get Google will actually give you a summary saying that the consensus now, not that we should trust it, but the consensus now is that histamine is pathological for autoimmune conditions. And they found by accident. I think they were trying back in like, 30 or 40 years ago, they were trying to give, because they suspected histamine is involved, but they thought it's low in multiple sclerosis patients. And I think they gave him either histidine, the precursor, or like injected him with histamine, and several people died. So they immediately knew the histamine is involved, but it was the opposite of what they thought. And then they spurred more investigations, and by now it's already established as a causative factor in irritable bowel syndrome, both kinds, the constipation and the diarrhea, which tells you that, you know, it can have both ways, right? The increase and decrease motility. In ulcerative colitis, probably at this point proven beyond any reasonable doubt. I think they're still struggling with Crohn's disease because they keep trying to prove that it's caused by a bacteria. There are several studies out there I've seen saying that there's something called Mycobacteria paratuberculosis, and it's known to cause Crohn's disease in animals. So they say, why wouldn't it be the exact same thing in humans? And they did a few small kind of like pilot projects with individuals, giving them very large doses of antibiotics for a very long time. And I think they managed to cure Crohn's disease in several people. But I think the reason the bacteria was able to invade the colonic wall and cause this chronic inflammatory reaction is due to the, you know, chronic irritation, the histamine and whatnot. And there are, you know, case studies published showing that histamine antagonists can induce remission in Crohn's disease as well. I already mentioned the multiple sclerosis. Rheumatoid arthritis is another one. There was a study I read a long time ago which said that the reason aspirin seems to help in rheumatoid arthritis is not so much its anti-inflammatory direct effect to the prostaglandins, but it's actually its antihistamine effect and anti-serotonin as well. So basically, aspirin stimulates the uptake of serotonin into the platelets, so it acts as a selective serotonin reuptake enhancer, opposite to the antidepressant drugs, the most common ones. And also, it's known to decrease the synthesis and the release of histamine. So that study kind of says, like, well, the fact that it works so fast, I mean, you can kind of like induce a remission in a rheumatoid person with swollen joints because of rheumatoid arthritis if you give them a 5 to 6 grams of aspirin in a single day. This cannot be explained, such a quick reaction, by the inhibition of the prostaglandins. Aspirin must have other effects. And now that we know that aspirin has effect on serotonin and histamine, my guess is that that's how aspirin is acting.
Yeah.
So if you take histamine antagonists, chances are you're going to help not only these conditions, but because histamine, together with acetylcholine, and they go hand in hand just as they do with serotonin. Histamine and acetylcholine are the two main pathways through which estrogen exerts its effects. If you block histamine at most of the receptors, you're blocking about 50% of estrogen's effects, even if estrogen is capable of binding to its receptors and doing whatever it does. And if you block acetylcholine, then you're basically blocking the rest of estrogen's effects. So anticholinergic, antihistaminergic drugs, the most common example, which is Benadryl, it has both of these effects, are actually potent anti-estrogens as well. And if you look, there are some studies lately showing that Benadryl has effects, surprising and shocking effects on estrogen related conditions such as breast cancer, right? Endometrial cancer. And they say, well, how is this possible? How is this possible? Well, because histamine and estrogen go hand in hand. Histamine and acetylcholine go hand in hand. So anyway, so yeah, if you find a safe antihistamine that sits well with you, chances are if you're taking it, it's going to not only relieve the chronic autoimmune condition, but it may actually put it into what doctors like to call permanent remission. They don't like the word cure.
So you think that all of these are basically caused from poor gut health as a root cause, or at least to some degree?
Not to some degree. I think the cause is always there. I don't know of anything, unless you're taking some kind of an environmental toxin. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say if you're a drug addict and chronically taking morphine, so you can probably give yourself an autoimmune condition just because of the chronically elevated histamine and serotonin without actually, you know, having any gut issues. But it will cause the gut issues because the opioid receptors are expressed there, right? So if you're taking, you know, an opioid drug, you will be increasing gut permeability and the synthesis of all of these vasoactive pathological substances. But for most people without any kind of environmental assault/trauma, it comes from eating specific types of foods. Like high PUFA foods are also a very common cause because they also have the effect of triggering the release of histamine, triggering the release of serotonin, increase the endotoxin absorption. Yeah, all of these things. They act very similarly actually to ethanol, since you mentioned ethanol, increases the gut permeability and the endotoxin absorption into the bloodstream. So, the polyunsaturated fats have a very similar effect on the gut barrier. To actually the shorter chain alcohols.
So do you have any speculation as to like why, let's say assuming this is caused by the same gut permeability, why someone would have Crohn's versus someone would have Hashimoto's versus, you know, all these various thyroid autoimmune conditions, which are really just like, they just call them autoimmune because they just don't really know what's going on pretty much, right? Other than the organs being attacked.
I don't know if you've seen, but over the last 2 years, they've been moving towards declaring all autoimmune conditions essentially the same disease, but on a very like a arrow on a spectrum, right? There's already a push to approve the drug. Actually, I think it's already been done. There's this famous drug called Humira, which used to be, I think it was developed specifically for Crohn's disease, but now you see ads for it for ulcerative colitis, for rheumatoid arthritis, for psoriasis, for psoriatic arthritis, and lately even for multiple sclerosis. So I think the medical field has already kind of realized that, look, it's all the same disease, because when we look at the systemic, when they're checking the biomarkers, right, the biomarkers for each of these diseases, they're the same. So you're not checking anything specific for that disease. I mean, looking for erythrocyte sedimentation rate, you're looking for C-reactive protein, you're looking for the interleukins 1 and 6, you're looking for tumor necrosis factor alpha, right? And conversely, drugs that work on every single one of these biomarkers, right? They work on all of these conditions. So it's really the same thing. Now, why does it manifest in a specific organ? I think it largely depends to how compromised that organ was to start with. I know people who work in dentistry, basically, I think because of they work around x-ray machines, even though they're supposed to leave the room when the x-ray is done, and actually they do leave the room. What happens is that the dental profession, I think, has an abnormally large rate of Hashimoto disease because the radiation mostly affects the thyroid, at least in the low doses. While people that work in places where there's like more, exposure to things that affect the gastrointestinal tract, especially small particulate matter, like in construction or around asbestos, they will get either mesothelioma, like which is the, you know, lung cancer, or some kind of a gut issue. Very often like inflammatory, you know, bowel disease, like a Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. I don't think it's known about, mm-hmm. but if you look at the actual ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, they're very difficult to differentiate. They're still arguing in the journals what exactly constitutes a differential diagnosis between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And I think the Crohn's disease now is saying ours is of bacterial origin. So we're going to treat ours with antibiotics. And now they're proposing to give these patients a course of antibiotics. If they improve, it's Crohn's disease. If they don't improve, it's ulcerative colitis. So yeah, I don't think they know, but they've already realized beyond, and it's hard to really not realize it, that they're all actually the same systemic inflammatory condition. And then they shouldn't really be treating, because they're not really treating something. Like if you're giving a TNF-alpha blocker, the TNF-alpha, you're not just blocking these receptors in that organ, you're blocking them everywhere. They've tried to create these drugs that are more selective, but they universally have failed, which kind of is also indirect evidence that it's not a localized condition. It's a systemic condition, just expresses locally.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how, like you're saying, if it's Crohn's, the antibiotics works, but it's like, well, the antibiotics are going to reduce histamine, serotonin, and all this stuff too. So it's like, you're just working it, like, you know, you're either working at the front end or you're working at the back end, but you're achieving the same result either way, and you're just giving us a different name for it.
Exactly. Yeah. And it helped for a while because there were, you know, medicine likes reductionism. So if we can take one disease and break it down into 20 different subdiseases, they will love that, because it means potentially 20 different drugs separate for each one of these. And it means a lot more money for them. Right.
Yep.
But that's not how it works. And they've kind of already, I think they've known it for a long time, but they liked the reductionist version because it was giving them more money. But now that the fact that basically most of the new drugs that are being brought to market fail, they've decided to start cross-approving drugs that used to be for a condition they claimed was completely different, but now they're approving it for something, you know, for another autoimmune condition. So you cannot do that unless you admit that they may be largely the same condition.
Yeah. Before we go in, we can go into some more drugs as well. I love your in-depth knowledge of pharmacology. It's so interesting. It's so useful in this aspect. Natural antihistamines. I know aspirin, which is salicylic acid, which occurs in some fruits and juices. I know theanine, one of like the T amino acid, is, they said it has like a pharmaceutical level of antihistamines. If you have any comments on that or any other ones that you like?
I think glycine is another one. It's known to decrease the inflammatory reaction caused by histamine. I don't think it's been worked out whether it's the direct histamine antagonist, but it does work on every single one of the effects that histamine does. So if it's not a direct histamine antagonist, it is at least a functional antagonist, because it blocks most of the effects. And I've noticed this in people who basically, like, when they eat some kind of an offending food that's giving them the histamine reaction, the flushing, right, the itchiness and whatnot, if they take it with a spoon of gelatin, or even just a few capsules of glycine, that reaction doesn't happen. So we know that glycine and possibly the other amino acids in gelatin work. I think the vitamin B3 is also a very good one. It's not a direct histamine antagonist, but because NAD, to which vitamin B3 is a precursor, is a cofactor in the degradation of histamine, I think that's basically increases the degradation, which lowers its levels, right? And then I think several of the steroids, such as pregnenolone, progesterone, DHA, testosterone, also very well-known one, dihydrotestosterone. For a long time, medicine has known that the quote-unquote female hormone, estrogen, exacerbates asthma, while progesterone and the androgens treat it. In fact, they can actually cure it. And they didn't know how up until, I think, like 4 years ago, when they released a study saying that, well, the main effect that these steroids have, at least on the asthma, is that, you know, estrogen is prohistamine and the steroids are antihistamine. Other things that are, several of the metals, such as magnesium and I think zinc, have an antihistamine effect. Histamine is capable of activating something called the NMDA receptor, which is a glutamatergic receptor, excitotoxic. And magnesium is an antagonist of that receptor. I don't know if that's the main manner through which magnesium works, but it's also known that if you give an animal injected with histamine magnesium, a hefty dose of magnesium, most of the inflammatory reaction disappears.
Yeah.
Other things, and of course, just like I said, anything that kind of like prevents the absorption of endotoxin will probably have antihistamine effect. So which means the charcoal, right? Not directly antihistamine, though. There is an old study, which of course I don't recommend trying this at home or asking a doctor to do for you. They created a solution, a water solution of charcoal, and they injected it actually intravenously in the animals. And I think it was done to basically demonstrate that it can have a curative effect on lethal endotoxemia. And I think it's also been shown to be able to drastically shrink the size of some tumors. But another effect that he had, it was drastically lower the histamine. And I think the way it does it is it's direct absorption of the histamine from which is circulating in the bloodstream.
That's interesting. So I was listening to this guy, Dr. Tyler Panzer, who I like his work a lot as well. And he was talking about that some people have issues with bone broth due to the high histamines in it. But I also thought it was interesting. He has talked about, and there's a decent amount of research, that glutamine helps seal the gut lining as well. Do you think glutamine can be useful in that respect?
Glutamine can be useful. Unfortunately, glutamine is a highly preferred fuel of cancer cells. In fact, glutamine restriction is now proposed as one of the ways, one of the metabolic aspects of treating cancer. So if you have like a dormant tumor or a small tumor that's actually active but kept under control by the immune system, if you supply a sufficient amount of glutamine, you may be able to like kickstart tremendously its growth. And I think glutamine can also be converted to glutamate, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not a good thing because it's an excitotoxic molecule. And it itself, glutamate itself actually activates both the serotonin and the histaminergic system. So I'll be careful with that. I think magnesium is the one that's been shown most reliably to heal the gut, to heal the gut lining. Gelatin is actually very well known to do that. In fact, it was used back in the day to even treat bleeding, ulcers, and perforation of the intestine, which is like the extreme degradation of the gut lining. And what else? Oh, yes. 5-HT3 antagonists are now known and proven to basically restore the gut lining, fully block the absorption of endotoxin from the intestine, which, as I mentioned, the 5-HT3 receptor being involved in increasing its absorption. And by doing that, these studies demonstrated that you can actually literally kill the animals by giving them nothing but pure alcohol, and they will die before they develop any liver condition. So, which suggests that most of the issues that alcohol causes, liver issues that alcohol causes, are actually due through the serotonin, endotoxin, gut permeability kind of thing, which damages the liver.
Interesting. You would prefer collagen or gelatinous protein over like a bone broth?
If it's in powder, I think it's basically because they undergo a filtration process. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, anytime you're dealing with a commercially mass-produced supplement, yep, there's a chance there could be heavy metal contamination and maybe something else. So
even if it's poorly sourced,
it can go both ways. Yeah, it can go both ways. So I will do both and see which one sits better with you. I think that if you boil the bones long enough, and I have to see, I think I have to check. I think adding like a little bit of acetic acid may actually help degrade the histamine. Yeah, so a little bit of vinegar. So if that works, then it's probably better to go with the bone broth. If that doesn't work, then I will try the collagen supplements. And they seem to be coming from very different sources. I've tried a number of different products on the market, getting vastly different results from each one of them. So that's actually good news. It means it's not a single supplier, because then you really don't have a choice, and just a bunch of resellers. It means it's coming from different sources, so you should be able to find something that works for you.
Sounds good. Well, if you want to try our collagen or Z-Broth supplement, we have a... let me know. I'll send you a bag.
I think I already tried it. It's really good. Actually, my wife uses it. And the reason I don't use it, because she uses it. Like whenever I buy it or she buys it, I'm not allowed to to go into her supplies.
That's funny. So do you think creatine is the same effect? Because I know it has anti-serotonergic effects. I could be wrong on this one, but do you think it is due to the anti-serotonergic effects that seems to help the gut lining and increase dopamine as well?
So creatine also works on the adenosine system. Mm-hmm. It can activate, I think, the adenosine 1 receptor, which tends to have an anti-serotonergic effect. And also activating the adenosine system, which has a sleep-promoting effect, histamine has the wakefulness effect, suggests that activating adenosine has either a drastic effect on decreasing the synthesis of histamine or increasing its degradation. It's not certain, but anything that has a sleep-promoting effect probably has an antihistamine effect. And since creatine, the adenosine system, is very powerfully sleep-promoting, chances are that basically it has an antihistamine effect as well. Now, conversely, it doesn't mean the things that antagonize adenosine promote histamine, which would mean the caffeine would promote histamine, which, however, it has been shown to be the opposite. Caffeine actually decreases the activity of the histidine decarboxylase enzyme. And I think because it also speeds up metabolism, you're going to produce more CO2, which probably allows more degradation of the histamine.
That was my next question. You read my mind. So is there anything wrong with using the more potent antihistamines, like what is Benadryl? It's
diphenhydramine, yeah.
Diphenhydramine. Is there anything wrong with using that like relatively consistently, or is there anything you'd want to take with that?
I think the older antihistamines, the ones that are basically the drowsiness inducing, they tend to be the safer ones. The newer ones that are advertised as like, you know, less drowsy or non-drowsy, unfortunately, the vast majority of them that I looked at, they contain either chlorine, fluorine, or bromine atoms in them. And the bromine seems to be okay. But the chlorine and fluorine, depending on how many of them there are, and it seems to be at least one, they can have liver toxic effects. But since most of the degradation of the whatever you're ingesting, whether through first pass or second pass metabolism, will happen in the liver. Our liver is really not designed; it's not evolved to deal with things that contain chlorine and especially fluoride. So sodium chloride is probably the only thing that we're meant to eat, right? Mm-hmm. And anything that contains these molecules, the reason it extends their half-life drastically. If you look at the older antihistamines, the half-life is like usually 4 to 5 hours. But if you look at the newer ones, they're saying, oh, you take one pill, it's going to last 2 days or 3 days. The reason it lasts that long is because it's inhibiting the liver's activity, ability to actually detoxify it and excrete it. And so look at the molecule. If it contains chlorine and fluorine, it's probably pretty bad. If it contains more than one phenol ring, it's also probably pretty bad because it tends to be estrogenic, things like that. So yeah, I think the older antihistamines, cyproheptadine is another one. Ketotifen is another one, very closely related structurally to cyproheptadine. And several of the, there's the several serotonin antagonists related to Benadryl, ketanserin and ritanserin. I don't know if they're commercially available. They're derivatives of diphenhydramine, and basically they've been shown to be able to block both serotonin and histamine. However, the good news is Benadryl, because of the structural similarity, that's why it was used as a starting drug for these other serotonin antagonists in lower doses, and I emphasize in lower doses only. It acts as an antagonist of at least three of the serotonin receptors. What do you mean by lower doses? No more than 75 to 100 milligrams daily. Why? Because in dosages over 150 milligrams daily, it starts to act as a potent SSRI. Mm. So basically, you're going to negate most of the good anti-serotonin and antihistamine effects, which may explain why clinical studies that use very high doses of diphenhydramine got negative effect for whatever they were looking for. It's basically, it starts to become toxic because you will increase serotonin and histamine, even though it's blocking them at the receptor level.
Can you get cyproheptadine at like a CVS or?
Not CVS, but you can get it from a compounding pharmacy or you can get it for animals. But ironically, a lot of people bulk it using supplements for animals. They actually, these supplements have to undergo more stringent testing and basically comply with more regulations for safety than the human drugs. So type cyproheptadine for cats, like cyproheptadine for dogs, and you're going to get it in syrup or in pill form and whatnot. So you can buy it online from many places.
Is it possible? And do we want to try to increase tryptophan conversion to niacin and away from serotonin? Because if for the listeners, tryptophan has two pathways, pretty much gets converted into serotonin or gets converted to niacin. Is this something that we can control at all? And is it something that we want to control?
Because you had a question there, is quinolinic acid bad?
Yep.
It is a known neurotoxin.
Okay.
Yes, it is very bad. It's byproduct of the kynurenine pathway, right?
Which is the niacin synthesis pathway, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But the way I think you increase it is basically if you take vitamin B6, which steers the production towards NAD versus the production of quinolinic acid. And just limit, I guess, overall consumption of tryptophan, but take some vitamin B3. I mean, most of the benefit we're getting from tryptophan is because of its conversion into niacinamide, and then ultimately NAD. Tryptophan has very few other roles in the body. It's the only amino acid that is directly carcinogenic. I think it's important to remember that. That is why probably it's the amino acid that is basically present in the smallest amounts. No matter what natural food you pick, tryptophan, if present, it will be in the smallest amounts compared to any other amino acid. We're simply not meant to be consuming that much of it. I think an adult can get by with about 50 milligrams of tryptophan daily. Most of us, I think, consume on the order of 1 gram daily, which is huge.
And do you think we'd probably be able to get 0 milligrams if we supplemented with niacin or niacinamide?
We do need some serotonin because the serotonin is involved in things such as blood coagulation and the intestinal motility, right? Mm-hmm. And also triggering, the immune response, right? If you get something that's coming from your intestine into the bloodstream, you do want the immune response to be triggered. But just like methionine, methionine is abundant in many foods, especially the grains. And several studies have shown that methionine restriction can actually exceed the life extension benefits of caloric restriction, which immediately demonstrated it's not the calories, it's not eating more that's killing you or aging you, it's specific components of the food. Mm-hmm. Methionine is one of them. And a recent study demonstrated if you restrict methionine to 2 milligrams per kilograms daily, which for a 100-kilo person, I guess 250 pounds, that means like 200 milligrams daily of methionine, which is nothing. We consume about 2 to 3 grams a day.
It's like an egg.
And that's... Yeah, exactly. An egg and meat, like in grains, you know.
Yeah.
So if we restricted to 200 milligrams daily, we basically, they were able to cure type 2 diabetes and obesity. So which shows you that methionine is a potent metabolic blocker. And we know it's a reductant. We know it's a thyroid inhibitor, right? So I think now that the studies have kind of established the tryptophan that we can get by on 50 milligrams daily, I think being cognizant we shouldn't be getting more than we need.
Yeah.
And one way, since it's very difficult to chase all these foods and see like how much tryptophan they have, it pays to remember that eating gelatin or taking aspirin and or maybe potentially if you take both, it will be even stronger. It has an inhibiting effect on the absorption of tryptophan from diet into the blood. Oh, and the branched chain amino acids. So the third thing that inhibits tryptophan absorption is also the branched chain amino acids.
I've been on your T-boosting stack, by the way. I've been using mucunapyr instead of the phenylalanine and the BCAAs. So if you can't tell, I'm huge now, by the way.
No. I mean, like, it's not necessarily about being huge. It's about being robust, having mm-hmm. very strong core, right? And muscle strength. Muscle strength is the single predictor, especially grip strength, is the single... Right? Best, and also morbidity. So it's not only going to live long if you're strong, but also you're not going to get frail with age. Nobody wants to live to 120 but be in a wheelchair for the rest of their lives, yeah. Right? So it's like strength is important, and keeping the serotonin low is known to increase drastically muscle strength, but grip strength in particular.
Yeah, that's interesting because anecdotally, I think people, fatigue is very related to grip strength. Like you have like a tired day and your grip strength is like tanked versus you feel good, you own into it. So that's interesting. Just like fatigue, we know is related to energy levels and NAD and all that stuff.
And to serotonin. There's something called the central fatigue hypothesis. So they noticed that they studied these athletes and they wanted to figure out why they get tired. And then they measured glycogen. They measured like various other like energetic metabolites in the body, like the Krebs cycle. And they're saying like, yeah, there's some decline there, but not enough to explain like how exhausted you feel towards like really the end of a very grueling exercise or some other activity. So they said something must be going on in the brain. And they found out that this something is serotonin. If you decrease serotonin levels in the brain, which can happen if you deplete tryptophan in the brain, you eliminate the fatigue. Now, it doesn't mean you never get tired, but it means you have a lot more room to run or like do whatever you're doing because energetically you're not depleted. Mm-hmm. It's actually the brain, which is basically saying like, this is too stressful. It's enough. I'm going to like kind of like send a signal to the rest of your body to wind down and you know, start to recover because I don't think I can take it anymore. So it's like the brain getting, I guess, overexcited, yeah. Releasing serotonin to kind of like numb the pain and tell you to slow down. So, but if you eliminate serotonin, you get I wouldn't be surprised if we see some doping drugs on the, you know, starting to get discovered, not in the not too distant future, that the new doping drugs will be acting on the brain, not necessarily like anabolic steroids and, you know, red blood cell producing agents.
So you'd use the BCAAs with a high tryptophan or like containing meal, one of the meals with the high amounts of the inflammatory amino acids, like cysteine, methionine, tryptophan.
Or spoon of gelatin, or if you're into supplements, if you can get pure ones, you can take like 3 grams of BCAAs plus about 2 grams of tyrosine or 2 grams of phenylalanine. And then that combo will both inhibit the absorption of tryptophan from the food that you're eating, right? If you take it with a specific meal. And also whatever gets absorbed, they will outcompete it for entry into the brain, so you're not going to get the serotonin effects. I'm sure you've heard they call it the Thanksgiving effect. Everybody gets like they get stuffed with turkey and they're all tired. And they used to say like, oh, it's because like you're eating a lot of these calories. And then they said, no, it's the tryptophan. And for a while they thought turkey has more tryptophan than other meats, and that's what's causing the serotonin effect, right? They realize it's a serotonin effect. But then it turned out it's because turkey meat, I think, has lower levels of the BCAA and or the phenylalanine. So that's why the tryptophan relatively more is getting into you and into the brain. So it's, increasing serotonin. So if you take,
Would L-DOPA work in that as well?
L-DOPA would work. However, it can cause desensitization of the dopamine receptors because you're increasing the levels of dopamine. So basically, when you're taking the L-tyrosine and BCAA, it's not that they, even though L-tyrosine is a precursor to dopamine and phenylalanine is as well, the synthesis of dopamine is rate limited. So basically, when you're taking these amino acids, it's more because they compete with tryptophan, in other words, to lower the amount of serotonin in the brain and not so much to increase the dopamine. You can do both, right? But it's when you're taking L-dopa, because it's a direct precursor to dopamine, over time it desensitizes the dopamine receptors, and it's a known thing, L-dopa resistance in Parkinson's disease. To this day, L-dopa is the first line of treatment, they call it, right? But if you take it for several years, especially at a higher dose, eventually you stop responding to it. As a Parkinson's patient, they have to switch you to either like a much more potent dopamine agonist, like bromocriptine, or I don't think they have any other solution. But even though it's available, lately studies have shown that the most of symptoms of Parkinson's disease are actually caused by serotonin. And the key symptom of Parkinson's disease is trembling and shaking, right? That is a symptom of serotonin overload. And I think we're going to see some, you know, studies, not too distant future, probably using things like cyproheptadine or potentially BCAA and L-tyrosine as like a dietary measure to block the increase of serotonin, which should allow the brain to recover and produce as much dopamine it needs without the need for L-dopa.
Gotcha. I read about that in school. They, for Parkinson's, they were using the dopa and it just stops crossing the blood-brain barrier and they can't figure out why, but that makes sense. Speaking of the amino acid content in foods, I was talking to Pedro de Amaral, Thucydides is his name, and I was speculating that at least, you know, monogastric animals like chicken and probably cows as well, but chicken and pigs specifically, that the pasture-raised versions that are eating, you know, they're going to be what they eat. So you could probably have a low PUFA, well, we know we can have low PUFA, but also like lower in the methionine, cysteine, and tryptophan content by feeding those animals specific foods, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course, yeah. So chickens and pigs are really good at like basically mimicking the diet. Whatever you give them, they will become very literate in. Now, the cows as well, but the cows and the ruminant animals, they have like this ability to transform the food into, mostly because the PUFA, they transform into saturated fats. Yep. But they also think they change a lot of the amino acids into their stomach before they actually gets absorbed. Not so much with the pigs and chickens and us, which whatever we eat pretty much gets absorbed as it is. There's a farmer who started like advertising a thing on the forum and several other places that are the Petarian community follows. He's basically feeding, I think, his pigs butter, or I forgot what the food, exactly composition of food was, but basically he sent Ray and some other people some pieces of meat, and they were the composition of those was basically like a red meat, like a cow, like a beef. Basically, it was very high in saturated fat, very low in PUFA, and it really tasted very different too. It didn't actually have the smell, the very peculiar smell of pork, which not many people like, but basically it was almost odorless. And even though it was white meat, it tasted and it cooked like a red meat. It actually took longer to cook, maybe because of the saturated fats, and it probably because it also changes the muscle fibers as well. So yeah, to answer your question, if you have a farm, giving your animals like, I don't know, gelatin in the food, it's supposed to be pretty cheap to get in bulk, right? To saturate their tissue, at least protect from the PUFA, give them like butter or like the polycosinols, because it can get by with by giving really small amounts. So there's a lot of ways it can be done creatively to create food that's really good for us. It just takes time, and obviously not everybody lives on a farm and can experiment with animals.
Yeah, and it's not as profitable typically. So saturated fats, are they protective in the aspect that they have a shield effect of the endotoxin, or is it mostly that they're slowing absorption and digestion, so less things are making it into the colon, which is decreasing the endotoxin response?
So a couple of things. First of all, most of saturated fats have a direct antihistaminergic effect and anti-inflammatory as well. Some of the mechanisms have not been completely worked out, but it's known. Like, you can actually try it out. If you have a wound that's like inflamed and red, I don't know if you should try, but like if you try rubbing some butter on it, then, or maybe first the PUFA, try rubbing some corn oil on it, notoriously high on PUFA, and see that basically it's going to get even redder and more swollen. And then basically wait a few hours and rub some saturated fat on it and see that the swelling will go away. Some of this has to do with changing the lipophilicity of the cell. Just the more lipophilic the cell is, the less it will absorb from the environment around itself. So if these saturated fatty acids are touching the wall of the intestine, they will absorb through passive diffusion and basically start affecting the enterochromaffin cells that are lining the intestine. Mm. So these cells will become less sensitive to endotoxin. There have been some studies claiming that things like palmitic acid can activate TLR4. These have been lately disproven. I can send you the exact articles, basically said that it's not true. When they were feeding this diet, that they said palmitic acid causes the TLR activation, it was the bystander effect. They were feeding also very high amount of PUFA. They were adding palmitic acid on top of an already high PUFA diet.
So, George, you said something really interesting. Do you view a leaky cell, for the listener, pretty much you can view cell, or I like to view cells as either watery or fatty, and the fatty cells are very stable. They have a lot of ATP, carbon dioxide, magnesium. First, the watery cell has nitric oxide, estrogen, then things are leaking out of the mitochondria, things are leaking out of the cell. I've always viewed leaky gut differently because it's like these zonulin proteins, but is that a misconception on my part? Is it just the same estrogen, nitric oxide, watery cells in the rest of the body is the same as the cells lining our gut?
They lose control of their water, which goes back to Gilbert Lind's hypothesis. Basically, the less ATP you produce, the less structured the water will be. So basically, the cells start to so it becomes bulk water, right? Yep. And in addition, because the histamine increases the permeability of the cell membrane, then this water starts to leak out into the extracellular space. So that's the leakiness, but it also goes both ways. A leaky cell can also absorb more toxins from its environment. So just as we said, if there's a lot of endotoxin in the colon, right, and serotonin and other toxins, then a leaky cell will leak its intestine into the colon, make it swell, but also at the same time absorb some of these toxic substances and make it swell even more. So that is my view of it. I think it's ultimately the inflammatory reaction and the low energetic state of the cell that allow it to leak substances out, absorb substances in, and generally stay in a state that basically, it's vulnerable to any kind of external or internal perturbation.
Interesting. Very interesting. So, George, you gave me one of these for the lipid bilayers, the cell membrane. And I know that Ray and Gilbert Ling don't subscribe to the lipid bilayer, the cell membrane hypothesis. But my all understanding was always that they acknowledge that it existed. They just don't think it does anything or is important because you can just rip it right off and the cell will continue to function. Am I wrong on that?
Precisely. Okay. I don't think there's a lipid bilayer that basically is kind of like keeping the cell. Well, there are lipids there and they tend to cluster on the outside of the cell because of the way the cell proteins are oriented. They have like a hydrophobic thing that's sticking, mm-hmm. basically the stick that's up to the outside, and a hydrophilic one that is pointing to the inwards, right? And the way you can prove that you can try to damage some cells, and if it was strictly a layer thing around the cell that's keeping it from falling apart, then some stuff such as minced meat, you should be able to actually grab a piece of the minced meat and squeeze it and get water to flow out, because all of these are damaged cells, right? That's not what happens. The water is still there, still bound. However, it tends to leak over time when basically the cells, because even though you get minced meat, the cells maintain their structural integrity for a very long time after the animal is dead. But after they start losing their structural integrity, in other words, after the ATP content gets completely depleted, then you start getting the leakage out of the cell. I think that the fact that there are lipids, but no actual physical layer outside of the cell, that has been known for a very long time. I remember seeing an article in 2015, a team at Harvard said, I don't know why, I mean, the guy who published the article, he's head of a lab there, he said, I don't know why I keep seeing articles in the press saying that there's a layer around the cell. That's not true. The cell is actually a gel. We should look at the cell as a cube or as a sphere of a gel, because the reason it maintains its structure and in this way is precisely because of the amino acids that are in there together with potassium, creating the skeleton around which water absorbs, right? And it's this electrical interaction between the water and the proteins that allows basically the cell to maintain its structure. So it's electronic. It's not physical, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not mechanical. Yeah. It is physical, but it's not mechanical. Conversely, if I like slice the cell with a really thin scalpel or puncture it with an electrode or do something else to it, mechanically damaging, as long as the cell is functioning and, keyword, sufficient amounts of ATP in it, then basically the cell maintains its structure. But if the ATP declines, then basically potassium starts to leak outside of the cell, and that disorders, that basically collapses the entire structure of the cell, the internal one. And you basically get just the debris floating around, which causes a lot of these problems that we mentioned earlier.
Yep. But Georgie, membrane fluidity.
The membrane fluidity is easily explainable by the change of its fatty acid composition. Cancer cells have a very drastically increased membrane fluidity, and it's shown that in cancer cells, the amount of free cholesterol decreases, right? But the amount of cholesterol esters, especially the cholesterol esters with polyunsaturated fats, drastically increases, which makes the outer layer of the cell, let's call it the outer portion or the outer sphere of the cell, makes it much more hydrophilic, right? And capable of accepting many of these substances.
Is that the esterified cholesterol?
Yeah. Say it again?
Is that the esterified cholesterol?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So cancer cells have a drastic decline in free cholesterol, which, by the way, is a phenomenon seen with aging. Ray had an article about the cholesterol and the esters, and basically like said that things that decrease this esterification enzyme that creates the cholesterol esters are known, have been shown already to have an anti-aging effect. Young people have a large amount of free cholesterol in their cells and low levels of the esters. Old people are conversely, and not only conversely, but the esters themselves are of the polyunsaturated fats, which allows, of course, a lot of these peroxidative byproducts to form and over time damage the cell, or at least interfere with its metabolic functioning.
And for the listeners out there, you can think about this like an egg. You crack the egg and it doesn't just disappear, even if you... It all starts to stick together, and that's because of this energy in the cell that has the ATP creates this negative charge that aligns the proteins in this way that creates this gelatinous type fluid, which is like a self-regulating thing. It's not just this big ball of liquid that is contained in this layer of fat surrounding it. And it's kind of like a little thing of jello, or gel, as Gerald Pollack talks about.
Yeah, gelatin cube. I mean, I think that's in a video. I'll find a Harvard article. They had a video which basically they plopped a cube of gelatin in it. And I think they passed an electric current to it. I forgot what it is, but they did some electrical manipulation where they basically destroyed the charge between the molecules, and this thing whole collapse became a blob, like on the table. So it shows you that even in gelatin, the whole thing is electronic that maintains the structure. It's not mechanical. There's nothing, there are no, like, I don't know, like metal beams and whatnot and keeping it together, which is kind of like the analogy of the lipid bilayer, is that there is a physical barrier that contains this watery solution of things that are floating around more or less randomly.
That is pretty interesting. So on Ling's hypothesis, I don't know, we mentioned this a little bit. How do you view the receptors in that? And I don't know if you have a great enough of an understanding. I certainly don't. But how do you view like the drug receptors in that?
Oh, depending on the molecule. I mean, several studies have shown that estrogen can affect a cell even in a complete absence of estrogen receptors. There's this famous triple negative breast cancer. Not only doesn't have the estrogen receptor, but it doesn't have, I think that it doesn't have a progesterone receptor, and I think it doesn't have even like an androgen receptor. Even then, recent studies have demonstrated that anti-estrogenic drugs still work on this cancer. So how do you explain that if the receptors are not there? Well, basically the entire cell is the receptor, and the most important aspect of estrogen's effects to the cell is probably energetic, because the estrogen itself is a reductant, yep. Right? When it goes inside the cell, it impedes the electron flow, creates the increased reactive oxygen species, right? Creates this inflammatory pro-growth state, also high estrogen relative to the other steroids. It's more hydrophilic. It's got two hydroxyl groups and a phenolic ring. So compared to something like progesterone, testosterone, pregnenolone is much, much less hydrophobic, right? Mm-hmm. Or more hydrophilic. This allows the cell to attract and retain more water. And this is a signal, the basic signal for the cell to grow is how much water actually can extract from the extracellular space and keep inside. So that's actually how estrogen really works and drives cancer. It doesn't need those receptors. The receptors are needed more for, like, I guess, genomic effects, right? It binds to the receptor, goes into the nucleus, and increases the transcription of several proteins. But I don't think medicine has even decided on what are the genomic specific effects of estrogen, because other molecules are shown to have the exact same effects. Like you said, the phenolic compounds, right? Something like apigenin or neringenin. Mm-hmm. They're basically shown to be capable of exerting effects opposite to estrogen, genomic effects opposite to estrogen, without the presence of the estrogen receptor in the cell. How do they do that, right? So it's not entirely clear, even to medicine, whether the receptor is even needed for the most basic effects that estrogen does, which is the transcription effects of, you know, increasing the synthesis or inhibiting the synthesis of this or that protein. Because other non-steroidal molecules, such as the flavones or flavanones, are capable of doing that in the opposite direction without the existence of any receptors.
So that's really interesting, which transitions us to another question I had for you. So the neurogenin, the apigenin, the flavonoids, they're all glycosides, which means for the listener that they're bound generally to sugar. And I was listening to Jay Feldman, and I don't want to put words in his mouth at all. I think he believes that a large part of the benefits of those compounds are from their effects in the guts, and he referred to them as selective antimicrobials. I just wanted to know, both A, what do you think is the effect they're having on the gut and like arranging our gut bacteria, and B, how much of it is also being absorbed into the cells and having an effect there?
There are both effects. First of all, they're present as glycosides in the actual food we're eating from, like, let's say, orange juice or grapefruit juice or, like, or papaya fruit. But once they get to the gut, to the microbiome, the bacteria that cleaves the sugar molecule, they become free and they get absorbed. Now, most of these molecules, specifically apigenin, naringenin, quercetin, tangeritin, present in tangerines, all of these, whether flavones or flavanols, are actually quinone molecules. If you look at them, yeah, they're actually capable of accepting electrons, so they're acting in a way similar to something like vitamin K, right? And many of the quinone molecules are known antibiotics, the tetracycline antibiotics being probably the most notable example. So once you get them there, if you get a sufficient amount of them, let's say like if you drink a glass of orange juice, you're probably getting about, you're going to get about 100 milligrams of naringenin, right?
Yep.
Once it gets cleaved, the glycoside molecule. So 100 milligrams of naringenin, it may be roughly equivalent to, like, I don't know, 100 milligrams of tetracycline. Very similar molecule. Both of these molecules can accept two electrons. Now, depending on the molecule, the more hydroxyl groups it has, after it gets into the body, many of these hydroxyl groups can get oxidized and they act as a redox molecule, basically. And I think all of the flavones and flavanols have already been shown to have that. If you type flavone and redox or flavanone and redox, several good studies pop up on Google claiming that most of the effects that we're seeing, metabolic effects that we're seeing of these molecules inside of the body, once absorbed, are really explainable by their redox properties. They're capable of basically regenerating NAD, in other words, speeding up the metabolic chain. All of them, without exception, as long as they have the ketone group on position 4, I think, are aromatase inhibitors. That group and the structure, the three-ring structure, has been shown to be crucial and sufficient for aromatase inhibition. They're very important, but as long as they have this basic structure, of which they all do, their aromatase inhibitors, they're also capable of binding and activating the androgen receptor. Very interesting study that I found by accident when I was looking for their steroid effects. It looks like if you have a hydroxyl group at ring A and another hydroxyl or ketone group at ring C, basically the structure geometrically perfectly matches the several of the receptors capable of binding estrogen receptor alpha as an antagonist, but binding estrogen receptor beta as agonist. And estrogen receptor beta is just like histamine receptor 3. It's an autoreceptor for negative feedback mechanism. So agonists of estrogen receptor beta are good. They will lead to lower synthesis of estrogen. Mm-hmm. Many of those were shown, not all, but many of those, such as chrysine and 7-methoxyflavanone, were shown to be potent agonists of the androgen receptor. So you kind of like have a testosterone, right? Because testosterone is agonist of androgen receptor and antagonist of the estrogen receptor. So you have these non-steroidal molecules that largely mimic many of the effects of the beneficial steroids that we have, and are more certainly antagonists of estrogen. Naringenin, I haven't seen the evidence for the others, but naringenin has already been proven to be a glucocorticoid receptor antagonist as well. And the study that I saw that kind of established that claims that this is probably the main mechanism behind naringenin's antidepressant effects. Mm. It's known that cortisol causes depression. There's several studies now with the cortisol blocker IU486 showing rapid antidepressant effects in a matter of hours, right? And naringenin had similar effects, increased, basically displaced dexamethasone, which is a very powerful synthetic glucocorticoid, displaced it from the glucocorticoid receptor, showing that it's actually a direct ligand for the receptor, and acted as an antagonist, increased the expression of the receptors, which sensitizes you to more cortisol, right? So you produce less. And that's really, if you look at depressed patients, they have higher baseline levels of cortisol, and there's the so-called non-responders to the dexamethasone suppression test. What does that mean? a healthy person, when you give them dexamethasone, then if you take a blood test, you should see a decrease in their levels of cortisol, because the body says, oh, you gave me a very potent cortisol, right? Synthetic one. I don't need my endogenous one. I'm going to decrease its synthesis, right? In depressed patients, this effect does not happen. Which means that the depressed patients, something is happening to their cortisol receptors that they're not sensitive. So even if you give them a very potent cortisol, they're saying, nothing changed. I'm going to keep my cortisol high. Naringenin basically increased the sensitivity of the glucocorticoid receptors, which led to a drastic drop in the endogenous levels of cortisol. And these animals that were on which the naringenin was tested basically started frolicking around and, you know, exploring their maze and, you know, general signs of decreased depression and, you know, joviality and whatnot. They started drinking sweet water again, very common test in people as well. Depressed people lose their preference for sweet stuff. To them, it tastes just as bland and uninteresting as anything else.
Basically, what you're saying is that and this is from a little bit ago, but so the glycosidic of the flavonoids, so they're all sugars bound to the flavonoids, are broken apart in the gut, and the quinones have antibacterial effects. So they're not only having antibacterial effects, similar to maybe like the carrot or some kind of antibiotics, but then they're going into the cell, being absorbed, and having these electron acceptor effects where they're increasing the metabolic rate, and they're also having these androgenic effects, which is going to be
anti-estrogen, anti-cortisol, pro-androgen, right? All of these things. Some of them are now actually, if you go and type on Google phytoprogestogens, mm-hmm. several of them, specifically apigenin and naringenin, are now called phytoprogesterones because they activate the same receptors as progesterone. So really a non-steroidal steroid-like molecule with all of the metabolic and beneficial effects that we know are associated with androgens and progesterone.
What do you think of the serotonin dopamine hypothesis? I don't know if you've heard of this, but basically, like, the mainstream view is that, like, you know, I fall in love with Georgie and, you know, we want to have intercourse and all that stuff. And you have the, like, what they call it, like the lovebird period, where it's the first couple months. They say that's the dopamine period. And then you have the serotonin period, which, like, we, you know, we kind of get to know each other and we, like, boom, love each other.
Yeah. Oxytocin. I don't think that there's any truth to it. I think what the mainstream medicine is trying to explain and push people towards is to accept potentially boring and, like, mundane relationships because it's somehow good for you, because it's stable. A lot of the research came out of the research with LSD, which the military did in the 1950s, where they showed that people who take LSD, which has a potent approximate anti-serotonin, but definitely pro-dopamine effect, basically these people stopped following orders. They started seeking novelty. They despised routine work. The only time they would become violent is if you could force them to do things like march in formation or like do squats or do sit-ups or push-ups, like for, I don't know, an exorbitant amount of time. They would revolt actively against that. So the government said, oh my God, that's terrible. We cannot have a society that doesn't follow orders. So they came up with the serotonin drugs, the SSRI drugs, right, which are mostly serotonergic. Some of them, very deviously, are actually partial serotonin antagonists, which I think explains their antidepressant effects, but they're still, the systemic effects are serotonergic. And serotonin has been shown, I don't know if you saw on my blog a couple of months ago, I posted it, it increases servility, malleability, and improves the learning of routine behavior. And those are things that are great for society because you go to work 9 to 5 like clockwork every day, like a robot, perform your duties and go home, right? You do the exact same things at home, whatever the routine at home is. You eat, you play with the kids maybe, you go to bed, right? And initially maybe you have sex with your spouse, but over time that disappears. And the reason is, and it's been shown, by the way, several studies, that if you give couples that are kind of like habituated themselves with each other and are no longer romantically attracted to each other, if you actually give them a drug that seems to act on the dopamine system, they start getting frisky again. So it's definitely serotonin involved, but I don't think anybody would agree that being like in a non-romantically desirable position with your partner is a good thing.
Yeah.
They're trying to explain the way, it's basically saying that, well, that's how it's supposed to be because you're supposed to rear children. They don't like an intense romantic relationship because it's bad for them. It's because it tends to be unstable. None of that is... There's no evidence for that, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at, there's been studies done on primitive, they call it primitive tribes. Some of the tribes in the Amazonia and other tribes that maintain their original lifestyle, mostly in nature, and they almost none of them have this like long-term habituated relationship with, I mean, many of them are monogamous. I'm not saying, I'm not advocating for polygamy, but it doesn't have to be like, I think it's the routine that really leads to the lack of interest. It's not the, not the fact that you're, you know, being with this person for a very long time. So I don't think that dopamine is bad for a relationship. I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's the fact that dopamine will actually make a lot of these people be intolerant to many things at work and in society that are detrimental to them. I think that's what's scary in the pharmaceutical industry and government in general. And we know, we have evidence that they are actively working to undermine the dopamine system. Because to them, this means people will be uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And I have... irrefutable by evidence. There have been briefs issued by the Pentagon and contacts between Pentagon and the pharmaceutical industry saying like, hey, LSD is terrible. I mean, it's great for the people, but it's terrible for us. Can you guys come up with something that works in the opposite way? And that's how the SSRI drugs came about. So serotonin is the survival hormone. It's the hormone of forming hierarchical relationships. It's the hormone of following orders. It's the hormone of tolerating routine, not loving it. You can love it. And the reason I say tolerating instead of loving is that very recent study came out just 2 days ago showing that the way the SSRI drugs really work is not that they make you antidepressed. It's that they completely kill your ability to respond to anything, both positive and negative, which is something we have discussed for a long time. They effectively lobotomize you. So if lobotomy, which is what a lot of couples that probably live with each other for a long time, will be like, our life is just like just one, you know, endless succession of events, nothing really changes. Mm-hmm. That's actually the serotonin making you feel that way. So if you change, you know, if you do something more spontaneous, or, you know, you're taking the dopamine drugs for whatever reason, chances are all these things will disappear. It's not the fact, again, we change all the time, but if our serotonin is high, it prevents us from seeing the novelty in this person with every, you know, with each passing day, and conversely, for them to see it in us. And if you can suppress serotonin or do things that keep it low, chances are that love will probably flourish until the end.
Georgie, that was very poetic. That was beautiful. So
thank you.
We just had a couple other questions. So lactic acid, sorry, I'm going to completely avert off from the poeticism we just heard. But so the role of lactic acid in containing foods and gut health, could the lactic acid actually improve like our ability to synergize with the hydrochloric acid in our stomach? And then how much of the lactic acid are we absorbing, and are there ways to mitigate that absorption from foods like sourdough or something like that?
I think you're absorbing a decent amount of it. The problem is that most of the external lactic acid that we're getting is produced by bacteria. And bacteria produces the D-lactic acid type. Mm-hmm. And the D-lactic acid type were not as well evolved to metabolize as quickly as the L-lactic one. We still do, but it has a much longer half-life in our body. And lactic acid, as you know, it's a reductant, it's a metabolic inhibitor, it's the most potent inducer of the angiogenic response of the vascular endothelial growth factor. It's the primary way through which tumors, maybe that's why they produce so much of it, is actually the way tumors grow, by actually overproducing lactic acid. But they produce L-lactic acid. So mm-hmm. D-lactic acid is just as bad, but it lasts much longer. So it has this ability to wreak more havoc. So it's not uncommon for people to eat just a single serving of sauerkraut and have headache for a while, right? And anytime you have a headache, chances are that serotonin is involved. The first anti-migraine drugs were all serotonin antagonists. One of the most famous ones, still approved to this day, is called methysergide, and it's an ergot derivative similar to bromocriptine, to LSD, to lizaride, etc. So if this is causing headache, then it's somehow increasing the serotonin. And since the serotonin is mostly produced in the gut, chances are that the lactic acid being present there is somehow irritating the intestine. Not completely known through what mechanism, but we know that lactic acid directly stimulates the release of histamine from mast cells, even when it's endogenously produced. Mm. So I will try to limit the exposure to such foods. Or if you have them, at least take things that can stimulate the synthesis, the conversion of lactic acid back into glucose, which happens through the Cori cycle in the liver. And the cofactors, the main cofactor needed for that is NAD. So maybe take some niacinamide with that sauerkraut. It should mitigate the effects.
I was talking about sourdough, but sauerkraut also applies. It is interesting, though, that sourdough is also a relatively decent source of niacin. The fermentation process.
I don't think sourdough is problematic. Eat it every once in a while. My wife loves it, but it doesn't have that much lactic acid. It's the sauerkraut and things like kombucha, which are now like the fad. Everybody's drinking kombucha. That is packs a massive punch of lactic acid, and it's the D type, which is even worse for us.
And if you guys want to know, so the difference between the D, what is it? D and R, D and L.
Yeah, DNL or SNR.
Basically, they're the chiral centers, which basically means they're a mirror form of each other. And for whatever reasons that, we just aren't built to process the D isomers. And, it's kind of basically the mirror image. And for some reason, so you'll have like D and L glucose, and we always produce, I believe, L glucose. And it's a lot more stable. It just has to do with the stability of the molecule and the enzymes that we need to process it.
Yeah, it's more the latter part. It's basically if the enzymes are geared to use the L, the D is still bindable, but since it cannot be processed, it kind of interferes, it competes with the L isomer, so it interferes with your normal functioning. It's usually still processable, not always. For example, something like the amino acid L-carnitine, if you take the R analog, right? The D analog, D-carnitine is actually non-processable, and in fact, it interferes with the uptake of carnitine of L-carnitine into the cell. But lactic acid is not as bad; we can still process it, D-lactic acid, but it lasts for a lot longer. And also, while it's there, since we also produce our own lactic acid all the time, right, just through the process of glycolysis, not all of it goes through the Krebs cycle, then it's going to reduce our ability to process the L-lactic acid that we're also producing. So you're going to get a double punch, in a negative way.
Is there any way to like mitigate the absorption? For, like, if you want to eat some sourdough, you're saying just kind of, or anything you can put in sourdough to kind of equate it? Or are you saying just eat those B vitamins to?
So the saturated fat usually, basically because it's the D-lactic acid is more hydrophilic and it's a reductant. If you make the cells lining the intestine to be less permeable, you're going to absorb less of those irritating and reductant substances. It's been shown that eating saturated fat inhibits the absorption of estrogens present in the food, and estrogen are not a reductant, right? But it's more lipophilic. So if you can inhibit the absorption of estrogen from the food, chances are you're going to be able to do that with the D-lactic acid and even more so.
Gotcha. We got a last couple questions for you. I don't know if you're running short on time, let me... No,
that's right. I mean, we can have like another 10 minutes.
Awesome. Is DIM estrogenic or anti-estrogenic?
Well, it's actually, I think the question is misguided, because what it does do is does shift the metabolism of estrogen from estradiol and estro into estriol. But estriol, even though it's considered a weak estrogen, the reason this kind of got into the public consciousness is that basically it's the estrogenicity is measured by the ability to bind to and activate the estrogen receptor alpha, of which estriol is indeed the weakest, but it's not a weak estrogen when you look at it metabolically and when you look at it carcinogenically. Estriol is only supposed to be present and discoverable, detectable in the bloodstream or urine of pregnant women. Any detectable levels of estriol outside of pregnancy or in a male universally mean the presence of a tumor. So that alone should tell you that estriol is probably not something that is good. So, and increasing, shifting its metabolism towards, in other words, shifting the metabolism of estrogen, which DIM does, from estriol and estrone to estriol, just because it's a weaker receptor activator, I don't think we have enough evidence to say that it's a safe estrogen. Because in animal studies, when injected, it reliably produces just as well, at the same dosage, liver tumors. I don't think, in addition, DIM is a very potent androgen receptor antagonist. And to me, that alone is enough to avoid using it. So if you want to decrease the estrogenic burden, taking quinones, whether flavones, flavanones, vitamin K, coenzyme Q10, methylene blue, it actually helps to oxidize estradiol into estrone, right? Which is, it is a bit weaker, right? But also estrone is more easily glucuronidated and or sulfated, which makes it more easier to excrete. So if you want to be shifting estrogen towards like a less dangerous, which I guess let's assume that estradiol is the most dangerous, but note, again, just to show you, the studies that I've seen show that they're equally carcinogenic. But let's assume estradiol is the most potent estrogen. The way to shift it in a preferable direction is towards estrone, which is more easily excreted than estriol.
Gotcha. What are your most effective methods for teaching yourself new topics and understanding them well in a short amount of time?
Depends if it's like in the biochemical field. I read PubMed all the time. I have a news recommendation system, which basically feeds articles. I've trained on the things that I find interesting, and that it recommends new articles every day. It's something that I built way back when I was still like mostly in the IT field. But as far as other things, I think if you expose yourself to a sufficient amount of novelty every day, when you broaden your perspective, you start to understand things more even if they're in a completely new field. I don't pick up many completely new things, you know, every day. I just don't have the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a new topic in the biochemical field, which is infinite, just like every other scientific discipline, usually if you spend several years reading in that circle, you especially if you broaden your horizon, don't specialize to the point of becoming like one of those people that work at NIH or like a pharma lab, and they know about this one enzyme, and that's all they know, that's all they do, right? It makes them actually, even though they may be very good experts at this specific topic, studies have shown that people who are overly specialized tend to have low IQ levels, and not just by association. In other words, over-specialization tends to dumb you down. So keep a broad perspective, right? And expose yourself to novelty as much as you can without getting overwhelmed. And I think that the learning of the new topic will take care of itself.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've experienced that a lot. I feel like there's so much value to seeking things that might be related or might not be related. Like, oh, you start making these connections. And I, in my opinion, I don't try to memorize things because, you know, it just kind of goes in one ear and out the other. I feel like if I remember something, it's because it's integrated into my like web, you know, and like it should be there. I don't try to intentionally to memorize things generally.
Have you heard of the movement called synecdoche? It was basically, it appeared in the 1960s, and it was the movement to study scientifically creativity. There's a book called Synecdoche, spelled S-Y-N-E-C-T-I-C-S. Mm-hmm. Google it. There are several books published, but the original one is published in the 60s. And they basically, they had a very simple mechanism. As soon as you get to a topic that you think you understand very well, they basically had a group that go in there and start to give you questions and contrarian evidence until you get utterly confused and you start thinking that you don't know anything. And as terrible as that sounds, they demonstrated repeatedly that this resulted in you making massive progress in the topic simply because it kind of got you out of this rut of thinking that, oh, I've got it all, right? That's all there is to know about it. So they call it alienating the familiar and familiarizing the alien. So whenever you're working in a very specific discipline, again, another, I've seen it in artists several times, they would like work in a very specific technique of painting. And once they feel like they're getting stuck, they will stop doing that and go into something completely different, right? What it can be art, but it can also be something completely different as well. Very famous mathematicians that were really good at mathematics, when they were stuck, they would go and like paint a painting or like try to compose a new melody. Einstein was very famous for basically, once he gets stuck into developing a scientific theory, he will drop it and go and play his violin for days until he gets a breakthrough. And he was only getting the breakthroughs while playing the violin. He said, I made more progress not doing physics than all of my years doing physics combined.
Wow. That's incredible. So try and stay humble and try and stay creative and seek novelty. That is the moral of the story. Awesome, Georgie. Where can everyone find you?
My blog, mostly, which is the same moniker as my online alias, Haidut, haidut.me. And that this feeds into my Twitter handle, twitter.com/Haidut, the same thing. And I also post on something called the Repeat Forum, one word, repeatforum.com. But it's usually, lately, it's only like a carbon copy of the articles that I post on the blog. So the blog is really the place to basically follow me. Or if you want to interact with me on the Twitter, I mean, I interact with people that comment on the articles.
Awesome. Oh, thanks, Georgia. This was awesome. We will talk to you soon.